Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the 2019 New Statesman podcast.
We kick things off by talking about the
quote-unquote migrant, quote-unquote crisis.
And you ask us,
should the parliamentary lobby be scrapped? Happy New Year, Stephen.
Happy New Year.
Parliament isn't back yet, but we are. And I tell you what, there has been a huge crisis, hasn't there? Huge, enormous crisis. I don't know about you, but I spent most of Christmas patrolling the wall at Dover. You wrote in your column this week, which I thought was a good intro, which is the Channel migrant crisis. Every word of that kind of deserves an asterisk to explain that it's not really... I mean, it is happening in the Channel,
you concede. Yeah, it is at least happening in the Channel.
But How many people is it? It's like about 100 people on boats.
It's about 100 people on boats.
And we summoned back two clippers, which I thought was a type of ship we didn't have anymore, but apparently we do.
Cutters.
Cutters, there we go, not tea clippers,
Yeah, clippers are the thingies that you can take along the Thames. So, yeah, most of them aren't migrants. They're refugees. It's not... 100 people is not a crisis if that word has any meaning. But it is, I suppose, taking place in the Channel.
I think both you and Peter Wilby in the magazine this week pointed out that Lebanon, at the time that Zan, our former colleague, went there, one in four of the population was a refugee. Germany took, in the span of 1 year, took 1 million Syrian refugees, right, and various from other places. Turkey has hosted hundreds of thousands and has been paid, what, 3 billion euros to do so by the EU to keep them contained in the region. Jordan has taken an extraordinary number. In terms of the mass migration of peoples, 100 is like a sort of rounding error.
So I think the numbers point is really important for a variety of reasons. The first is actually when you look across Europe, even places like Austria, which have taken on the most per capita, have had to absorb significantly fewer refugees. And because, even though you may have language issues, particularly if you are, if you're any kind of migrant, you mostly have quite a lot of social capital. So you are, in some ways...
Well, lots of people coming out of Syria were kind of doctors and university graduates.
Yeah, it's fairly easy to integrate into society. We're still talking about a smaller number than the number of people who immigrate into London every year. And a significantly smaller number than the number of people who immigrate out of London into the rest of the country.
The number of overall asylum applications in Britain are lower than the number of people immigrating to London every year.
The number of people who have asylum applications to Austria who've had the most per capita, about 10 million people in Austria, about, depending on how you count, 10 million people in London.
Yeah, don't make me get John in to tell us how many people live in London, because that argument could last all day.
The point is, right, these are not society or particularly expensively large numbers of people to take. However...
And 100 people in the Channel certainly isn't, right?
Of course, if you look around the continent and indeed the United Kingdom itself, the movement of comparatively small numbers of people clearly has been politically dislocative. It's an approximate factor in the emergence of Lega Nord as the dominant force on the Italian right. Although I don't think it was the major driving factor in the Brexit vote, it was clearly part of the subtext of it. That was one of the things Vote Leave were aiming to do with their whole the Turks are coming, Albania is going to join, etc., etc. So the two major driving forces of this are political upheaval and climate change. Now, it may be that you can do something about political upheaval for a variety of reasons. However, given that it looks fairly likely that the new Brazilian president, as well as being a fascist authoritarian...
A homophobe, a sexist...
Is also probably going to do
log
some quite major deforestation.
The entirety of the Amazon rainforest,
So climate change is not a factor that we look likely at the moment as a global political whatever to
arrest.
Well, not
least there are already parts of India that are experiencing record high, you know, high temperatures of 47, for example. Like there was a piece in The Guardian last year, which I thought was fascinating, about it's like, what does the city look like at 50 degrees? And that is, you know, the places that reach extreme temperatures in the next century will move to being places that have got millions and millions of people living them. It won't just be the middle of Australia.
And I think this is the thing, right, is that given the way that Europe has responded to these actually tiny numbers, it doesn't, I would say, make me feel particularly optimistic or non-terrified about the direction that politics will take when Bangladesh, population 161 million, which is below sea level, is underwater, and all of those people have to move. Most of them will move into India. That is not without politically dislocative changes. And the odd thing is the politics of how these movements of people are dealt with in Britain is exactly analogous to how we deal with it in Europe and across the wider world. In that, basically, everywhere that isn't a town in Kent, pretty much, it's like, well, that looks alarming on the news. We'll give you some money to deal with it. No, we're not going to let any of the people who've come here work, even if they have perfectly good qualifications. And it's your social problem. And essentially, that is what most of the, well, particularly the United Kingdom, most of the nations who are not themselves directly within, you know, kind of migration patterns have gone, oh, well, that does seem like a pain, but we've got a channel, so I guess we'll just give the Austrians and some Italians some money to deal with it for us. And basically, in microcosm, neither of those approaches to managing these very small movements have worked well.
But on this, I've gone proper red string on the court board, which is that I believe it's an entirely confected row in order to hobble Sajid Javid's chances of the Tory leadership election. I think it's a cynical manipulation of a non-crisis. Gavin Williamson also, let's be honest, probably pretty excited about sending a boat in somewhere. That means that he gets to do something that looks kind of defence secretary-ish and macho. And Sajid Javid being forced to kind of cut short his holiday feels like a kind of, I think as you wrote in the column, you know, he's seen as the current, he and Jeremy Hunt are the current front runners in that leadership race, and it seems to me to have been slightly spun out of whole cloth, really.
Well, so yeah, I mean, so yeah, one cabinet minister before the break, I went for lunch, kind of have a, you know, well, how do you think it's going? And they said, Saj has peaked too early, because if you peak this early, everyone starts taking pot shots at you, and if you're at the Home Office, everyone is going to have loads of opportunities.
The cursed department.
To do so. Now, there's obviously an element of that, and you know, and all of the kind of, oh, you know, he needs to come back from his expensive holiday in South Africa, and just like, and do what? Look stern at his office, which is basically what he's
done. Have a big photo of himself taken behind his desk looking cross about stuff.
Yeah, so all of that is about the Tory party leadership.
But I just think there's a bigger story here, which is, and something that Rob Ford, who's Professor of Politics at Manchester, did a tweet about things that he was going to reappraise. He did like a version of your blog post about, you know, what I got right and what I got wrong, and said that he had underestimated the media's power, because, you know, we can be very fashionable to be kind of cynical, like, oh, you know, everybody's not sheeple, they don't just do what the media tell them. But equally, well, we know that, for example, in surveys, people drastically overestimate the number of Muslims in Britain, right? They just think that basically every other person is a Muslim, and, you know, in way out proportion to what the real figures are. Ditto, I think, the same thing about the, we know that migration as a concern for people has dramatically dropped since the 2016 referendum. But at the same time, overall migration has definitely slowed, but it's not fallen off a cliff because, you know, we haven't left yet and all these other reasons. And I think that stuff is really interesting, that this does seem to be, you know, in a way that Donald Trump, incredibly cynically before the midterms, just kind of created this whole thing, the phrase migrant caravan, right? This idea that there were all these people heading for the border, which he then dropped as soon as the midterms were over. There is something there, I think, about the way that subjects are distorted to look much more, you know, much vaster problems than they are for cynical political reasons. Where did that story come from? Like, I feel like it was probably being briefed, right? In the same way that I felt very strongly with what was that farrago in Parliament that we all got in the neck for reporting hugely large-scale bundlings about Andrea Leadsom and the Speaker and stuff like that. And you were like, well, the reason that everybody was talking about that and tweeting that was being aggressively briefed and used for fundraising purposes by the Tory party. Right, this story does feel like it's kind of not organically.
Stupid woman gate. Oh, God, that's something I had.
He'd left, happily left in 2018. But I sort of feel like this story as well just feels like it hasn't organically arisen from people seeing boats, and it has been ginned up.
I think that's partly true. There is, however, you know, one of the things I don't understand, and it, of course, may be the way that the rise of social media is changing communications in a way that really only the invention of the printing press itself is analogous to. But the idea of migrant crossings clearly is...
It's evocative, isn't evocative it? People, as you saw, right? When Nigel Farage stood out in front of that Breaking Point poster, which I don't think even represented what... I can't remember who actually, where those people were crossing particularly. I don't think it was
they
particularly...
I think they were crossing into Albania from the...
From whatever's next to Albania. You know, someone said, I can't believe you didn't know where all the US states were. And over Christmas, I watched the episode of Friends where Ross says he won't have... I know you hate Ross, sorry. He won't have Thanksgiving dinner until he's named all 50 US states.
I mean, so I...
Let me tell you, Minnesota is often very hard to remember under pressure. I tried the game myself.
So I'm going to... I'm not going to defend myself on my Albania brain freeze.
Yeah. Moldova?
But... No, basically it's, you know, your frontier states into Eurasia. Because I think that's much less defensible because it's the continent in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly believe that British politics would be in a better, healthier position. There are people I follow on Twitter who are already tweeting about, like...
Elizabeth Warren's
announcement video or whatever. It's just like, guys, it's an election in which... Basically, we all end up hoping that a candidate from the right defeats the creature from the pit. That's basically all American elections in the 21st century. It's not healthy to get...
I know, I'm already pre-bored of the fact that Donald Trump is going to basically, like, on day one, kill a child, day two, say that, you know, snakes are evil, day three, he's going to accidentally bomb Mexico, and then, but the whole thing will be like, well, on one side, that stuff, on the other side, is Elizabeth Warren really Cherokee? I just can't, I'm pre-bored of it, and I know I've got another 18 months of being bored of it.
But yeah, other countries do exist, and it is perfectly respectable not to know where Arizona borders if you live in Europe.
Okay.
Is my take.
I'm just saying, if you want to do that thing where you have to try and name all 50 states, I only got to 36 in the time required. And that's because I was very excited when I got Vermont and Rhode Island, because let's be honest, they're not really proper-sized states. But then there's a lot in the middle that is really very hard. I mean, Kentucky.
But I think what I find is bizarre about it, right, is I would be willing to bet you'd find it easier if you got, you know, let's pick a group, not even a little bit at random, political correspondents in the United in the Westminster Parliament,
the lobby, yes,
to name US states,
yep.
You would have a better chance of people getting it right than you would if you asked people to name all 650 members of Parliament,
or even all 27 countries in the EU under time pressure.
And the thing is, those are both things which are just much more obviously things than people ought to know about.
Okay, well, on that note of we'll go away, that should be our 2019 resolution. We should go and do some, like, geography lessons. It was always my Achilles heel. It will continue to be throughout 2019.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us!
So this actually effortlessly segues. My segues have now got out of control to a point that I segue to bits which do not need to be segued to because they happen in... So this is a question that people started to ask over the break. Well, and people intermittently ask, which is top of mind because obviously I'm, you know, now political editor and I now have...
Congratulations, by the way. I would let off a tiny party popper, but you'll just have to settle for me going, yay, instead.
And now have exactly no powers than I didn't really have before. But yeah, it's
you're very
title.
Much the sort of Brexit secretary of the NS now. Yeah.
But it's nice to have have a new shiny title. I'm thinking of getting a hat. But it's sort of top of mind for that reason, which is, should the parliamentary press gallery be abolished?
Yeah, and James Ball, who writes for us occasionally, wrote about this over the break. And actually, when we did the Deep Dive podcast, which Stuart Wood and Ian Leslie did for us, they talked to Laura Kunzberg, BBC political editor, and some detail about this. Her defence about it was that, you know, because of the access, even if you're nobody, you know, you're the kind of lowliest reporter number six on the Mirror, you can go into Parliament, you can kind of grab hold of people and have a conversation with them. Whereas in more tightly controlled systems, it's much more about who you know, and actually access is much more controlled. I'm kind of sympathetic to that, but I also am sympathetic to the idea that what it does is creates a kind of court stenographer role, and a kind of also a bit of a Versailles. And I think actually you can make many of the same criticisms you make about the lobby as a physical entity, about political Twitter, which is basically sort of the digital version of that, right? Which is that everybody gossips among themselves, they talk too much to each other and not enough to people outside, and that things become a thing just because everybody's talking about them, and they're the kind of things that are easy to talk about, right? So stupid Womangate, everyone can have an argument on that. No one can actually ever finally decide what it was that Jeremy Corbyn said, apart from Jeremy Corbyn himself. So we can all have an opinion on it. Safe knowledge will never be debunked. That is a much more sexy thing to talk about for an afternoon on Twitter when you're quite bored and you can't really bother to go outside than it is to go and crunch through the latest like National Audit Office report into whatever.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, it's something I've been thinking about because of this handover, and you know how I will, in terms of the very limited things that I can change, what are the things that I will change about our politics coverage? One of which, of course, is the PMQ's review. George always did in a way which did very well traffic-wise, a kind of like who won match report approach. I don't particularly enjoy or like that.
Well, it's kind of
style.
Broken in the era when neither May nor Corbyn ever wins, right? They both, it's like Alien versus Predator. They just, whoever wins, we lose, right?
Well, the thing is, I feel that what tends to happen is that
so it doesn't shape the narrative of the week in the way that it used to, right? It's become a very different thing, so our coverage should probably reflect that.
But I also think even under Cameron Miliband, who are both very good at it, it's not a form of journalism that I'm particularly fond of. And obviously you then think about, like, well, you know, where do we do our journalism from? You know, is there a problem with the fact that, you know, Patrick and I are in the lobby, you know? So I realise I disagree with both the arguments we've talked about so far, in that Laura Kaye's sort of argument for it is great in theory, but when you actually look at who the party leaders are interviewed by, they of course do control access.
Yeah, they take questions at press conferences. It's always Laura first, then it'd be like Faisal, and then it'd be like, you know, Peston, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, and you're one of the great myths that is very easy to buy into as a journalist is this idea that, yeah, in terms of, like, for example, Labour and Lib Dem criminology, which is the thing that we do to an extent and a scope than very few other publications bother to do. And it's very easy to start convincing oneself that it's because I, Stephen Bush, am great and talented. The reality is that it's much easier to do criminology if the power players in it read your publication and are interested in having their intellectual and their criminological, as it were.
Yeah, and they feel that your readers are people that they need to win over. Right?
Advanced within it. But equally, all of those incentives don't go away if you physically move people. So, yeah, one of the periodic problems, of course, is that people in the press gallery, by definition, you do not become an expert on social policy or transport policy.
This is one of the things I think is a really big problem, is ministers briefing something to a poll core who is brilliant at who knows what about stuff, but is not necessarily the person who's going to be immediately able to read the complicated announcement and go, well, hang on a minute, this isn't new money, you've just reallocated something before, or whatever it is. You know, like the Chris Grayling with the whole thing they had about the prison officers, where they were like, 7,000 new prison officers, and you're like, hang on a minute, like, 5 years ago, you just cut 10,000. So these aren't new prison officers. This is like there is now less of a deficit compared with than there was a decade ago.
Yeah, but the thing is, right, that incentive structure never changes, regardless of where someone physically is. And actually, for the most part, there are two ineradicable problems. One, in terms of the physical location of our PMQ's coverage, it doesn't matter whether or not you had someone doing it watching a computer screen here or doing it in the office. I think, and obviously I will revisit this in 6 months' time, but I think an approach where you cover it from what has this taught us, rather than, well, which one of these
1-0, 2-0,
gets you a different result, regardless of whether or not the person who's doing it is there. There's a reason why, you know, for example, in Amber Rudd's first appearance before the Welfare Select Committee, before the thing, you know, I asked Anoush to do it, because Anoush does the bulk of our social affairs reportage, and I know she's across it. And I kind of think, in another way, this kind of, like, blame the lobby, move the lobby, is one of those ways that we talk about and a lot of time institutions do matter, and institutional change is more important than any personnel change. But some of the time it becomes a way that we avoid talking about personal responsibility for coverage decisions made and not made. One of the many things I like about Patrick is that he understands that ultimately, like, yeah, this kind of, I can't remember which BBC correspondent it was, but on the night that it became apparent that people were going to resign in large numbers over the deal.
This is Theresa May's post-checkers, yeah. Is it the November one that she brought back? Yeah.
They said, oh, and the third thing is the deal might not pass.
So, first of all, Dominic Raab and Essam of Air out of the cabinet. Second,
Theresa May could face a challenge. And the third thing is the deal might not pass.
We may all starve to death in April.
The thing which could lead to stockpiling is probably the first thing, right?
So, okay, how about this criticism? Because I remember having this conversation with Raphael Baer, late of this parish, now at The Guardian. He wrote a great piece when we did our Race in the Media special, and he focused a lot on the kind of the huddle, you know, the kind of idea that you kind of get together with other people and talk about the line, about, you know, what is it that such and such a person really meant when they said stuff, and the ways in which that could be troublesome. He also, in that piece, obviously mentioned the fact that the lobby is incredibly white, and it's not just male-dominated, but it kind of, I think, quite blokey in its sensibilities, too. I mean, I say that from the perspective of an outsider. It's never been the kind of journalism that I've been particularly attracted to, so I've never been a member of the lobby, so that may be slightly unfair. But I think the kind of public school nickname kind of culture and stuff like that, I find that a bit off-putting. And also physically, because it's up in the eaves, isn't it, the press gallery? Yeah. What about, you know, what's the disability access like? You know, all that kind of stuff that comes from working in Parliament. I think it has a kind of quite an exclusivity to it that is... I think when you're, like, when you talk to somebody like Harriet Harman about the difficulty of getting, quote-unquote, women's issues, you know, covered, then I think that was a lot more difficult for her in the 80s when almost all the parliamentary correspondents were men, right? They're kind of, because there is a sort of pack mentality, it's very susceptible to, if your pack looks very homogenous, then their idea about what the story is or what's an important issue and what's a sort of side issue will also be, you know, come from a particular perspective too, and that is no one's individual fault, but it is a facet of the way that it's structured.
Yeah, I mean, so there are obviously the same physical problems of Westminster, you know, being hellish for anyone with any mobility disability, etc., etc., are all, and it has then the same problems of journalism in the early 21st century, which is, you know, intense social rarefication.
Yeah, everyone will have a degree, you know, everybody, I mean, I imagine most of the people voted Remain because they're probably from that, you know, socially liberal background.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Based in London, obviously.
Although, I mean, the lobby is definitely whiter than, say, the NS office, but it's also definitely less educatively exclusive than we are, for example.
That's interesting. What, because you've got sort of the old tabloid reporters who might have left school at 16
Some people who've left school at 16, you also have more people who haven't just gone to Oxford, right? So, I mean, this is the thing, right?
Because that's the thing that Roman used to get me when I first worked at the Mail, was that I started working, and it was a long time ago now, with a generation of sub-editors, often who had come through local papers, right? And then, therefore, left school at 16, gone to work on their local paper. At the time, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you had to spend time before you were allowed to come to Fleet Street. Like, you had to spend time on a regional. And actually, what that meant was that there was a more socially diverse group than, whereas now journalism is, like, yeah, like, you know, you say, not just very graduate, but, like, very Oxbridge, too.
Yeah. And, yeah, kind of in a weird microcosm, you know, it's the problem of, like, which you can easily demonstrate by walking into any newsroom the day after an Arsenal defeat and seeing how many people are upset about it. And you think, well, that probably shouldn't happen. And this is kind of what I mean about how I think some of the things that people, because in an odd way, right, it's always easy to talk about things as a proxy issue. And I think some of the conversations that British journalism has about the lobby are ways of kind of going, like, let's talk about some problems we as an industry have in a controlled environment that we're not in. I also kind of, the huddle, there's a conflation of two things. The huddle is not where people go, the huddle's a bit where basically anyone can ask questions of the Prime Minister spokesperson or the leader of the opposition spokesperson. What then does tend to happen, and I am not proud to admit that I have in a previous life done this, what then does tend to happen, particularly on, say, actual example of something which did happen in 2015, during the Labour leadership election, the first and most fun of Corbyn's two leadership elections, I and Conor Pope, then of Labour List, were basically the only people covering it day to day. Whether it was at Westminster or, you know, some launch at some kind of, you know, social charity, you know, combining business entrepreneurship with rehabilitation, of the kind that people do Labour leadership events at, we would often be the only two journalists there. And inevitably, you do go, oh, how are you? How's your folks? What do you think then the most interesting thing about that was? Because in an odd way, right, in terms of that Labour leadership election, if I had missed something particularly big, the only way you would know about it would be if Connor had spotted something particularly big. So you do have an incentive to kind of semi-conspire. You also, of course, have an incentive to beat your near competition. So I think that kind of ends up working both ways, right? But yeah, all institutional structures are prone to groupthink, and it's certainly no exception. But I kind of think, again, it basically comes back to what are your institutional mechanisms for challenge within your own publications. Because, yeah, one of the big problems that has been really evident with a lot of Brexit reporting is because, as with all newsrooms, people are kind of tied to their desk, having to do six stories a day, often six very good stories a day. You do have, taken another concrete example, the reporting of the parliamentary arithmetic around a people's vote. An awful lot of it was based on people being like, but wait, are there any Labour MPs who wouldn't vote for it? And of course there is
That's an institutional problem about the fact that it's much easier to report what people say than it is to report things that are actually happening, if you see what I mean. And I think that's one of the big problems with political journalism. It can just turn into a contest of claim and counterclaim. And it's certainly something that I think the BBC report into what they felt they got wrong in their Brexit coverage and in climate change coverage. You fundamentally, like, things are happening or they are not happening, and things are, predictions have been made by a certain group of economists, they haven't. It's sort of irrelevant what Jacob Rees-Mogg thinks of it. He's literally some guy, and that I think is one of the big problems of the kind of that he said she said kind of model of political journalism.
But it is, I think, again, comes back to wider problems with the industry. And one of the so the other thing that I am very keen to change is, and for understandable reasons, it's very difficult for people here in Basecamp to see the work that we are doing that is not the production of copy. But it does mean that you end up in a situation where you go, this is another concrete example, because particularly before Patrick arrived, when I was essentially in many ways a desk of one, I was having to work so hard. I didn't have as much time to get to know the 2017 Labour intake as I would have liked to early on, which would mean if you said to me kind of like, oh, what's the view among the average Labour MP about the war on drugs? I would be able to tell you. But if you want, what do the 2017ers think? I go, well, the Tories I can have a pretty good idea of, because of the internal ructions, and I've mainly been covering in that party, I've got a better grip on it. But I'm afraid I have to go, like, no idea. I honestly do not know what the politics of a large chunk of that new intake of Labour MPs believe, because you're always incentivised, as with every other bit of journalism, to do
pump content. I think this is a huge problem in modern jobs. I've been reading a couple of things in the last couple of days about, there was a brilliant piece, I can't remember, I think it was a Huffington Post, about a woman who worked as a quote-unquote cable guy, installing cable, right? And before that, there was a piece on, I think, The Atlantic, about a guy who used to be a sports journalist, is now an Amazon delivery driver. Two jobs in which you have a set target every day. You have this many drops you have to make. And what it does is it both those jobs kind of assume that there are metrics that can just be, that every job is a lump of a certain amount of time. And what they, the woman who's writing about being a cable guy said two things were holding her up. One was she was given the more difficult cases. This has always been the problem with stats into, like, heart surgery, for example, right? The surgeons that often look like they're doing worse are often the ones who accept the hardest cases, and which therefore have the highest failure rate. So actually, you have to be really careful in interpreting the stats. The same thing with these jobs that are very highly metricized, and that is actually what is somebody cherry-picking these jobs. And in case of the female cable guy, the bit that sticks with me, the guy's the Amazon delivery driver, had said, look, I spend most of my time looking for something. I'm in my 50s now. I spend most of my time looking for somewhere to have a wee, and eventually I ended up having to go in the back of the truck. And then the female cable guy was like, well, I'm having all this problem because I'm constantly driving around looking for a public bathroom as a woman, right? And these are the things that won't be taken into account when these jobs of the future, where everything is about a metric, about individual circumstances that might stop, that in the same way that gender is, or sex in this case, is a differentiating factor. And I think the same is really highly true of internet-based journalism. The kind of metrics only capture the thing that you're measuring, and they often do it at the expense of flattening out everything else.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a large ramble, but there was a point to it, which is, you're right. You can either say, Stephen's had a really great day today, he's produced six blogs, but that might come at the expense of, Stephen has had a really great year in which he has broken X story because he nurtured this contact and developed it, and it paid off in 3 months, in the 3 months' time.
Yeah, and I kind of think that increasingly, I just don't believe that getting rid of the lobby fixes any of the bad incentives in British journalism and political journalism in particular. I just think the princess is in another castle. So basically what I'm saying is then it's not my fault, it's your fault.
Well, what I would like to see that I think would really help is, again, better nursery provision in the Palace of Westminster. This is something we talked about, something that the Speaker, for all his faults, did introduce and got rid of a bar, which there was much kind of wailing and gnashing of teeth about. And some positive action schemes. You know, we've run previously one for science journalists in the past. I know the Guardian have done stuff around BME journalists, but there should be, I'm not sure, the equality of opportunity is really not there. And it's a difficult system to fix because unlike a political party in selection of a candidates where they can say, this is our quota or this is our target, there's everybody is sending their individual people. And so what you'll get in the case of women is everybody will send, you know, three people or up to five, six people, sometimes in the case of the really big organisations, and they might send five men, or they might send four men and one woman, but it just all stacks up and then the overall picture becomes incredibly unrepresentative, and there's no way for anyone to fix that, particularly when really what the issue comes down to in terms of sex, I would say, is about childcare and the fact that it's a job that often keeps you there really late at night with irregular hours. You know, you might just have to junk everything, and unless you've got a very understanding partner, that's a very hard thing to do when you're also caring for young children or elderly parents, right? So that's the thing. Don't scrap the lobby, we've decided.
Scrap capitalism.
Yeah, smash the patriarchy and end capitalism. Well, that's a nice note to start 2019 on. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Nick Hilton. Why not start the new year off right by subscribing to Stephen's Morning Call? Simply search Stephen with a PH, Bush Morning Call.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.